you can, Whiskers. You told me to dress for dinner, so I put my dinner togs on, and now I'm the only one.
We're not having dinner, Mr. Wendover. We're having luncheon.
What time is it?
12:55.
Well, it's dinner time where I come from.
If you'd taken the trouble to read the brochure as I suggested, you would have discovered that we serve luncheon at 12:30 and dinner at 7:30.
Oh, something to do with crossing a dateline, I suppose. Oh, well, it's a bit of a relief, really.
Oh, this shirt's killing me.
Mr. Wendover, try and get it right. We only wear a black tie at dinner. Have you got it?
Only wear a black tie at dinner?
Correct.
I've got it. And I've got witnesses. I shall take my repast in my cabin. Thank you.
Evening, this afternoon and this evening, I normally what I do is, you know, 5 minutes before we start recording, I jot down a really crappy little intro, and I've not had a chance to do it. So, I mean, are you ready to just to kick off now, and we can just
just no bother at all. I'm in your hands. I'm in your hands.
brilliant. So, I'll just say hello and welcome to Goonpod. Ding dong. How about that?
Perfect.
There we go. This week, I'm delighted to welcome. Now, so many strings to your bow here, John. Correct me if I'm wrong. Actor, writer, director, and co-founder of Hambledon Productions, John Hewer. John Hewer.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes, thanks for having me here.
Did I miss any?
No, it's jack of all trades, master of none. It pretty much is, yes. I can't sing, I can't dance, so when I entered this industry, it was very much a case of seeing what else I liked doing. And writing's my main thing. I like to do writing, but that pays the least, I've found out. So directing very soon followed that up. And and I've fallen into this craze of, you know, reviving classic comedy. And I absolutely love doing that. Yeah.
You're a relatively younger man than I am, John. but like myself, you cleave very much to the older comedy and comedians, I guess. Oh, is that right?
Absolutely. I'd say anything from 1917 to about 1998 is kind of where I sit. And in the middle of that is the 50s, 60s and 70s. And yeah, I'm 36, turning 37. And I always say I was brought up very, very well. I was introduced to that kind of, the golden age of comedy, as we call it now. By my dad in particular, who was a school teacher, head teacher, very, very busy job. But he would always free up Sunday evenings to spend some time together. And on BBC Two or Channel Four, they'd be showing Carry Ons on Channel Four. And on BBC Two, they'd be showing Porridge and Fawlty Towers, The Good Life and that kind of stuff. And my love for this kind of classic comedy kind of all stemmed out from that. And I got to be honest, Carry On films was my biggest interest, probably still is. And of course, you exhaust those 31 films, and you go, you know, Sid James, Kenneth Williams, Hattie Jakes, what else did they do? And you go into Hancock's Half Hour and their own sitcom stuff. And then that then transpired into the Goon Show. My grandfather and my mum's dad, who's still with us, he's 95 next month. Exciting time. Ooh. Wow. And he's a huge Goon fan, loved Spike Milligan. So anything quite anarchic or zany, I'm saying in inverted commas, kind of came from my granddad. So Marx Brothers are huge influence on my work. And the Goon Show, I think, is a very close follow-on from them. And so that kind of side of my work definitely stems from my granddad and Spike Milligan in particular. And I'm lucky to have done Spike works, you know, with my company, with the Bedsitting Room and the Milligan Papers. And it's wonderful to be a very, very, very small wheel in that whole, you know, reviving his work and keeping his name out there.
You've played Spike You've appeared.
that was a strange one, how that came about. Jeremy Stockwell, who I'm sure you're familiar with, the brilliant Spike. It transcends an impression. It really, really is. He was in line to play Spike in the Milligan Papers tour we did in 2018 to mark the centenary of Spike. But he couldn't do it, so I ended up stepping up to playing Spike Milligan in that sense. But The Bedsitting Room was the big one. The Bedsitting Room was the film I watched in my teens. And so let's think now. This has been about the very early 2000s, and it wasn't yet on DVD. There was no VHS release. You couldn't find it on YouTube or anything like that. And it did crop up on eBay, I think, as one of those, we're in the public domain kind of films.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember buying it, and I remember being completely in awe of it. It really was my favorite film for a couple of years.
Okay.
And I just wanted to do, and it was based on a play, and of course play is my main love, theater is my main love. So when I read the play script, which of course is very different from the film in many ways, and I wanted to restage that, and so we very luckily were given permission to do that in a couple of years ago now. And Jeremy Stockwell, we did fly him over to play Spike, and that was such a wonderful evening. Jane Milligan was there. It was wonderful to be able to have said that we did that. It's very, very special to me.
And was John Antrobus involved at all?
John was very much, very much keen for revival. He wanted to turn it into a musical. I'm looking back on John's CV, a musical is kind of the only thing he hasn't done.
Yeah.
So I think there's a part of that, and he had these wonderful ideas, but sadly, the whole, not necessarily sadly, but the whole ethos behind it was to do it as it was in 1962 or 63. That was kind of a big part of it, but he was very supportive of us, and I think he's still tinkering away on it, hoping to get a revival, full production to be done soon, hopefully.
Yeah. Today, this week, we are talking about the 1970 film Doctor in Trouble. Starring Leslie Phillips, Harry Secombe, Robert Morley. I've got a bit of a... I need somebody to work through my Robert Morley antipathy with, and it may as well be you, John.
Oh, yes.
I've got a real thing of... not a real thing, it's an act, I suppose it's an act, but his pomposity and his... just the way he always looks permanently startled. So
he,
I don't know what
is,
it is.
He is the same in every film. I think that's pretty true.
Well, that's true.
I think it's in Roger Lewis's Peter Sellers book where he does something like comparing Robert Morley to like some gargantuan elephant who just comes onto the screen every now and then and completely tries to own the whole scene. And yeah. I completely see where he comes from in that. I've got a problem with Robert Morley, but it is an act. And when you think, if this was made 2 years earlier, that part would have been played by James Robertson Justice, and I think the film would have been a better outcome for that. But
absolutely. Oh, and we almost forgot Simon Dee, of course, is in this film.
Oh yes. Now this is tricky for me because I wasn't around in 1970 or the 70s at all, and so I didn't realise at all who Simon Dee was, and I had to kind of figure out, and then to figure out this was probably his only major film, I don't know, a kind of a flash in the pan kind of career, would you say that? I don't know.
Well, I've done quite a bit of research about Simon Dee, so I want to, at some point in our conversation, I want to talk about his kind of downfall. His rise and fall, as they say.
Right, yes.
Very interesting guy. His own worst enemy, I suppose.
Right, okay.
And I only knew him when I was growing up because Victoria Wood mentions him in one of her sketches. That's the only... I think that's the only reference to Simon Dee I'd heard growing up. But we'll come to him.
Oh! Oh, sorry, mate. Don't tell me. The lodger in Coronation Street. No. The TV advert for false teeth. I've got it. Dr. Philip Dare.
Yes.
Thought I recognised the old mush. One of your greatest fans here, Phil.
Good.
I'm the Wen and Wendover. I just won the pools. Don't spread it about, otherwise they won't be able to pull the birds off me fast enough.
Mr. Beecham.
Yes.
I recognised you immediately, sir. The captain asked me to take you down to your cabin and look after you, and he'll be in touch with you just as soon as we're safely at sea.
Well, thank you very much. I hope to be asleep by the time we're at sea. I'm afraid I'm not the best of sailors for the first couple of days.
Well, there's nothing to worry about on the Golden Horn, sir. We're as stable as a gyroscope.
I'm very glad to hear that.
Here, just a minute.
Would you like to come this way, sir?
I would, actually.
What about me?
What?
I mean, if you're the bloke what trips the tickets, I'd like to know when I'll shake down.
Yes. Now, I do like to be thorough in my research as well. if you Google Doctor in Trouble...
Yes.
You have to wade through pages and pages and pages about GPs being struck off for the various things. but I did manage to find quite a bit to talk about with regards to this film and those who appear in it, as I said, about like Simon Dee. Why this film? Is this one of your favourites? I'm guessing it must be.
I think it is. It's certainly one of the Doctor films I go to more than the others. And I guess if you were to look at the Doctor series very quickly, you know, seven films, 1954, 1970, this is the last one. And they sort of fall into two categories. There's the very, you know, quintessential 1950s kind of, you know, what I call the Ian Carmichael factor. Yeah. Ian Carmichael's not in these films, but it's kind of got that kind of feel to it. Very, very
Ian Carmichael, Dirk Bogarde kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was Dirk Bogarde in them, actually?
Dirk Bogarde's in a lot of them. Dr. Simon Sparrow. And the first film from 54 is really excellent. I'm you know, honestly, it's very much timeless. And he's supported by, you know, Kenneth Moore, Donald Sinden, and of course, Jane Robson Justice. And the first one is excellent. And then they kind of did... kind of not capitalize on that with the sequels. You know, Doctor at Sea came along in 55, Doctor at Large in 57, and they all kind of got progressively weaker. And Dirk Bogarde basically just wasn't invested in it anymore. He then jumped ship, and Michael Craig came along in 1960, co-starring with Leslie Phillips in Doctor in Love, which tried to kind of, you know, regenerate the series, I suppose. And that didn't work. And they got back Dirk Bogarde for one final outing for the fifth film, Doctor in Distress, in 1963. And then it was decided to basically chase the carry-on wagon, as far as I could tell, with the sixth film, 1966, being Doctor in Clover, where we have Leslie Phillips really taking on the mantle by, you know, Donald Sinden and Kenneth Moore. And then that brought us to Doctor in Trouble. And I think of the later ones, this is my favourite, you know, bizarrely, as it was the last one they ever made. But I do prefer this to a lot of the earlier ones. I think the first one is the best, unsurprisingly, maybe. But this one, it's not a classic at all, but it is still a very good film. And I watched it again last night, and it has got that kind of familiarity feel with it. And, you know, to go with those names already listed, Irene Handel's in there, John Lemessurier, of course, is always in there, Graham Stark. You know, they're good troopers, aren't they? and we're always very grateful to see them, yeah.
Yeah, but what's really confusing is that, why isn't this called Doctor at Sea?
Well, they made Doctor at Sea. I think that's the problem. And sadly, there's a couple of reviews online, official reviews from critics saying, you know, this feels like the, you know, the offcuts of Doctor at Sea, which I really do not agree with. I think they are two very different films. This does feel very much like a carry on. Whether you and it'll, you know, it'll stand up on that, whether you like carry on or not. And but when I was watching it last night, it felt like one of the later carry ons. There's a lot of nudity going on in Doctor in Trouble, and it felt to be spicy even for like the late 60s, early 70s.
Well, at one point Leslie Phillips says the word bastard about six times in rapid succession.
Genuinely shocking.
And he's saying it to Simon Dee, so he probably had grounds for saying it, if Simon Dee's reputation was anything to go by. But it's based on a book called Doctor on Toast.
Yeah,
I prefer Doctor on Toast.
Yeah, I have not got to the bottom of that one. yeah, I've got most of the Doctor novels, and I haven't got that one, but I'd be interested to see exactly how much of this. I mean, it was screenplay by Jack Davis, who had handled a few of these in the past, mostly known in my books anyway for writing on the Norman Wisdom films. And it's certainly got that strong slapstick element to it. Which again, you know, if that's your bag, you will love this, you know, or it might leave you cold. But it's a Jack Davis script, and exactly how much from Dr. on Toast he took. You know, that's something I need to look into, to be honest.
You mentioned James Robertson Justice. Now, he does have a very small walk-on part in this film, right at the beginning. And you can, if you know about it, you can see it. You can see he's got one hand shoved into a trouser pocket.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of a suppressed tremble of his arm. Right. So was he effectively dying at this time, or certainly very ill?
Yeah, he'd had a stroke a couple of years before. He had an operation after the stroke, which hadn't gone according to plan, I think. And then he was basically offered another operation with like a 50% chance of it being successful or not. And people were like, do you really want to go through with this? But he did. And this is him basically coming out of it. And I think this is I think this is his final film, actually. I think he died about 5 years afterwards. And you're right. And I knew he wasn't well, when I first saw it, I'd read up on that much. And you think so, because you know he was a good third in all the other previous films, and people only had this kind of walk-on cameo, really. Let's be honest, it was very sad indeed. But no, when I did reread the biography on him, and I watched those early scenes with him in, you could tell, you know, yeah, you're right. He's got his left hand in his jacket pocket, and also when he has some close-ups, you can tell he's reading the auto cue card behind Simon D's head a couple of times. So It's good to have him, you know. I wouldn't want to lose him, but it is sad and slightly awkward that he's not in this one so much.
Absolutely. Oh, we forgot to mention, of course, there's a python.
Yes.
In this film. There's an asp and there's a python. the python in the shape of Graham Chapman, who plays a fashion photographer called Roddy.
Rodney, yes.
Or is it Rodney?
I think it's Rodney then Roddy. Yeah.
Right. And Graham Chapman, very much against type, playing a gay man.
Yes.
There's a couple of gay stereotypes in this film. Roddy is one of them. And there's a particularly egregious stereotype at the beginning when Simon D's character is being mobbed by adoring females.
That's right, yes. Which I hadn't spotted until last night when that little bit came up. I was like, oh, that's... thing that got under my radar earlier on.
Well, that kind of representation was default homosexual around this period, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Now, did Graham Chapman had some involvement with the script on this, did he? Or
not on the film script, to my knowledge, but he and John Cleese did both co-write the opening episode of the Doctor in the House TV series, which had started in 1969.
That's it. That's what I was getting confused with.
Kind of, I think the producers, Betty Box, who produced all the seven Doctor films, I think she was given first refusal to actually do a TV adaptation. And then when James Robson Justice was clearly not going to be around for it to happen, to work on it, I mean, she basically closed the book on it and said, not interested anymore. So I think ITV or ATV, whoever it was at the time, bought the rights from her, and they went with that, and it was a Chapman Cleese first script. And then the goodies, I think, you know, Bill Oddie and Graham Garden wrote a lot of them.
Yeah, well, Graham was a doctor, wasn't he?
And
of course, an uncredited appearance in this by Jeffrey Davis.
Yes, he's there. He pops up. Yes, like a ceremonial, handing over the hat, really, isn't it? Because he kind of played that role that Leslie Phillips plays so well. You know, the Dr. Burke, I think he's called in this one, Dr. Grimsdyke, he was called in the previous one, for the same Leslie Phillips character. And I think he's got that kind of lovable rogue kind of role in the TV series.
Yeah, Jeffrey walks in on Leslie Phillips' character. And I was saying to friends, I'm going to write a monograph, a short monograph, on the films and television programs from the 70s, which have scenes where there are photographs of topless women pinned to the walls, because
create a new list, a very short list as well, of films which have various starlets going on photo shoots.
Yes.
Because there's, I don't know if you've seen it, Vampira, 1974, David Niven.
Heard of it.
It's a similar thing. All these dolly girls, you know, they all get on a plane, they go to Transylvania for a photo shoot. And then there's Spanish Fly, 1917.
Heard of it? It's meant to be dreadful, isn't it?
It's Leslie Phillips and Terry Thomas.
Okay.
And again, let's ship them all out to somewhere hot and nice and to take some photographs and that kind of stuff. But yes, definitely a trend. Definitely a trend.
Yeah. We've barely mentioned Harry. Now, Harry, when we get to Harry, Harry is wonderful in this. Harry is, so, for me, and obviously I'm biased, I suppose, but he's the standout.
He's so, so good. In all the films he did, he's really remarkable, I think. And he could totally hold his weight here against these people who have made, you know, dozens more films than Harry had made by this point in his career. And it's excellent, I think, yeah.
Well, he's dialed it up to 11, and he's playing a character called Llewellyn Wendover.
That's right, yeah.
Cheerfully crumpet mad pools winner with no social graces. And I suppose you would unkindly describe him as common as muck. And
he's, absolutely, yes.
It's his first time on a cruise, and he doesn't know the etiquette. And he's got an eye for the ladies, and all sorts of shenanigans occur. Is the whole purpose of the cruise for him to find a wife potentially? Is that what we think?
I think that's a polite way of putting it. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It's interesting because the character name, not Llewellyn, but there's a Wendover in the previous film, Doctor in Clover, played by Arthur Haynes. I think passed away between that film and this film. So whether he was lined up to be in this one as well, I'm not too sure. But it's great to see Harry Secombe. I think he made quite a few films around this time.
Yeah, Sunstruck was a couple of years later. There was Song of Norway, I think the same year as this.
Right.
Oliver, of course, the year before. I think it was the year. Was it 68?
Yeah.
But he's... Oh, and there's The Magnificent Seven Deadly Sins.
Great, yeah. I'm all for that.
Which also has Leslie Phillips in it.
That's a guilty pleasure, yes.
and directed by Graham Stark. And I heard Leslie Phillips say about Graham Stark that very nice man, very nice man to act with, but not a very nice man to be directed by, apparently.
Oh, really?
Bit of a tartar on set.
Ah, okay.
So there we go.
I mean, there must be something because, he didn't do many, did he? So, yeah.
I think he did that. I think he did Simon, which is a short film.
Yeah.
With Sellers in it, briefly.
Yeah.
You know, talking about the Carry-Ons and how this is more or less a Carry-On in all but name, I suppose, in many ways. Well, it's not actually, is it? Because there's none of the principal cast apart from Joan Sims and...
Yeah.
I mean, Leslie Phillips was sort of an early Carry-On regular, wasn't he?
But semi-regular for the early days, yeah.
Yeah. But it opens with very Carry-On style credits and music. It's Eric Rogers behind the music.
I do think that the musical scores of this type of film, you know, often goes unnoticed, and I do, you know, they do punctuate so many of the gags, and it's not just all, you know, long trombones and swanny whistles. You know, there's some really wonderful stuff going in there, and I did notice that Harry Secombe actually has his own like theme tune whenever he comes on. That kind of thing, and it's lifted from Carry On Doctor. It's Bernie Breslau's theme tune, if you like, from Carry On Doctor, which was made in 1967. So it would be quite fresh in Eric Rogers' mind, that, and I spotted that, you know, recurring theme. And there's a wonderful bit at the party, which has got some music in from a similar party scene from Carry On Again Doctor, which was made the year before.
Yeah,
And there's the Janet Mahoney's strip tease scene from later on in the film, includes a musical theme from Eric Rogers, which he returned to constantly throughout the Carry-Ons. I know there's some kind of saucy dance. It's the same piece of music. So I'm thinking of there's a strip tease scene in Carry-On Behind in 1975. and a similar one in Carry On, Emmanuel, from 1978, and it's the same piece of music. So, that piece of music, whenever it comes on, I'm like, oh, there we go, Eric Rogers.
Just, we're talking about that striptease. I mean, that came as no surprise that it was that. What's the character's name? Dawn.
Dawn Daly.
Dawn Daly was referred to as a dancer throughout this film.
Yes.
And then it's announced that this party that she's going to dance for the delight of the passengers, and we all knew it was going to be a striptease, didn't we?
Of course. Come on.
I love that scene as well, because you've got the cap to bloody Robert Morley. You've got Robert Morley looking startled and saying to John Lemez,
"It's great, isn't it? Yeah.
You don't think she's going to take everything off, do you?" And John, in his best Sergeant Wilson, says something like, "I rather hope she does."
Absolutely, spot on, yeah. Which you do not expect. It's wonderful.
No, he's delighted by it all.
You don't think she's going to take everything off, do you? I rather hope she does.
The film opens with an operation happening, and the surgeon collapses and dies. But before he does, he
start nominates... the laugh, guys. Start the laugh.
Yeah. He nominates the dishy Dr. Dare as the only surgeon capable of completing this operation. And we then realise that it's actually a television show. And Dr. Dare is the actor Basil Beecham. It is Basil Beecham, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Played by Simon Dee. And the name Dr. Dare, I'm assuming it's based on Dr. Kildare.
Yeah, sure. I presume. Yeah.
And then we see Leslie Phillips and about a dozen nurses watching this on television at the hospital.
Uh-huh.
Leslie Phillips' character Tony says that he was at school with Dr. Dare. Now, Phillips was 46 at this time,
right, yes.
And Dee was 35. but Leslie Phillips really trading on that sort of youthful good look still, or trying to.
He was, and he kept that going for the best part of the 10 years. Until this kind of comedy, I guess, was not as fashionable. There wasn't much money, this was the last one they could finance, wasn't it? And he wanted to ditch that persona and then chase a second career, which he did very, very well, didn't he, of course? But he's raffish best here, I think.
He's a bit put out by the clear adoration of the nurses for Simon Dee's character. And then he's called out to a swanky house where the resident is supposedly seriously ill, and it turns out to be Basil Beecham's house.
Now, sorry to cut in there. I spotted it straight away. I spotted that act sign, serious straight away. And it's, I ran to my Carry On books, and it's a location used in the very closing scene of Carry On Up the Jungle. And it's Clarence Crescent.
Wow. Okay.
Probably in Windsor, knowing Carry On a lot, probably Windsor. And yes, it was used in Up the Jungle, which was filmed in 1969. So yeah. I guess, with the family background of, Betty Box being Peter Rogers, I guess, I'm looking for a house, that can do this kind of exterior location. Oh, you want this place. It was a tip for that kind of thing going on throughout the two franchises, really. But yes, there it is, 11th Clarence Present.
And like you said before, the sort of the smutty tone has crept in here, and you've got these dolly birds essentially sort of draped over the banisters as Tony Burke is climbing the stairs, and then he examines Basil, and he thinks it's his appendix, doesn't he, I think, and then he says something about take your shirt off or unbutton your shirt, and the girls start to unbutton, of course, and he stops them. he says, "Well, you might want to do that later," says the old dog. I really laughed when we see the next scene is Basil's taken to hospital, and Dr. Burke tries to tell the nurses that he's not all that.
Oh, it's Dr. Philip Dare.
Well, he's not bad.
He's got false teeth, spots.
Oh, it's not true.
Yeah, wears a wig. Knock knees.
Morning, sister. Dylan's going on here.
Just brought in a new patient, sir, an actor. Hypochondriac, of course.
Of course. What's the matter with him?
He says he's got appendicitis, sir, but personally, I think he's here for publicity purposes.
Oh, he is he? Well, I'm not standing for that.
You're quite right, sir.
This could be a carrying on from Doctor in Clover, where the main, well, one of the plot points in that film is Leslie Phillips's character trying to get with it and trying to, you know, adapt to you know, this swinging 60s permissiveness. And it's a little bit like the ending of Carry On Camping. It's like, you know, Sid James and Bernie Bresler are all for the permissiveness until it turns up in a you know, a field next door as some rowdy, you know, the Flower Buds pop band, whatever, and they steal all the young girls. So it's a little bit like that. It's kind of trying to tap into modern trends, but also kind of poking fun at it. And I think there's a little bit of that in this film as well, in Doctor Who, where you know, Leslie Phillips' character trying to adapt to, you know, to the latest hot craze, which in this case is Simon Dee's character. And there's a lot of comedy to be taken out of that, I think. Yeah.
Well, he's also. By the way, Carry On Camping was the hippies, wasn't it?
That was, yes, yeah, yeah.
Don't they try and kill the hippies?
Yeah, they completely spoil their fun. They blow up all their, you know, electric guitars, and they pull them all through a hedge on a tractor. You know, yeah, you know, it's you know, they're trying to just, you know, go away from all of that. So it's an interesting part in the series where basically Carry On went from being, you know, trendsetters to you know, kind of falling behind the times a little bit, I think.
Yeah, and you said about Leslie Phillips, well, his character in any case, trying to be a bit groovy and
yes,
with it. He's also got a young girlfriend.
He has.
Which is the actress Angela Schuyler.
Schuyler.
Who I wasn't familiar with in terms of, I couldn't recognise her from anything until I looked her up, and she was in a couple of Bond films. She was also in Casino Royale. You know, the Sellers Casino Royale.
Yeah.
But I recognised her because she had a regular role in Urang Milord. As one of the...
Of course, yes,
one of
did.
The lady somebody or other.
Yes, she did. Much well.
So she plays Dr... Oh, God, this is going to be confusing. Leslie Phillips' character, Dr. Tony Burke, she plays his younger girlfriend.
That's right.
And
Ophelia O'Brien.
What was that?
Ophelia O'Brien is her name, yeah.
Ophelia O'Brien, that's right. I mean, if it had been the Carry On films, it would have been something like Ophelia Knockers or something.
Hopefully, probably. Yes.
But she, the actress and Phillips, actually got together several years after this and married.
Yeah, I thought they got together on this film, but no, you're right, it was a bit later. They'd just done a play together called The Man Most Likely To in the West End, and yeah, she's back in this film, and quite high billing, actually, I thought it was a very secondary role, but no, she's there a lot more than I thought she would remember to be. And yeah, I mean, she's great in it. Yeah, she's very good in it.
I won't go into detail, but she took her own life in 2011 in a very dramatic fashion, which people could look up if they wish. But obviously had a lot of things going on, and... But they had been together for many, many years.
She was actually in the early stage of pregnancy when she made Doctor in Trouble. So it was Angela in Trouble, I think, really. yes, from her first marriage, I think. And then I think Leslie very much became, you know, the stepdad, really, when they did get together. So, yeah.
Yeah. The plot here is that Dr. Tony Burke has got a job offer in America, but he needs to get married in order to clinch it.
Yes.
I guess they don't want an unmarried man. I don't know. Back in those days, I don't know. So he's going to propose to his girlfriend Ophelia, and so he goes to a flat, and she's getting ready to go out with a film director who's a real drag.
Oh, yeah, there's so many of these terms, which I was like, this effervariki. I actually had to put the subtitles on to see what she was saying, because she says it quite a few, effervariki. And I was like, she's actually saying, I don't know if that was a common term at the time or it's been thrown in the film. But yeah, there's quite a few of those references in there, which is great. You know, it's a bit of a time capsule, I know, but it's great.
It's possibly about 3 years behind, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Just like when... Terry and June had that episode where they dressed up as punks. You know, they missed that boat by about 4 years.
Yeah, in 1989, yeah.
So he's gone to propose to her, but she's going out with some film director, and she's not going to be able to see Tony because she's going on a cruise to do some modelling, as we referred to earlier. So he decides to try and go and, you know, meet her on the cruise ship before it sets sail and propose to her. And the ship is called the Golden Horn.
Yes, I did spot that. Yes.
Yeah. And as I say, we got Basil Beecham as James Robertson Justice as top surgeon Lancelot Spratt, who's a fan of the television series, or he's a fan of Dr. Dare.
Yes.
He diagnoses that his illness was wind, and recommends a holiday, and he suggests a cruise on the Golden Horde because his brother is the captain.
Yes.
So there we go. So we've got Leslie Phillips, we've got Simon Dee, both about to get on the boat, and then we see Harry Seagam arrives, and there's a lovely little scene there with Simon Dee, who he recognises, and he thinks he may have seen him on Coronation Street. And then he twigs that he's Dr. Dare, and he says to Basil that he's a pools winner. He says not to spread it about because they won't be able to pull the girls off him fast enough.
Yes. But it's all this stuff from Harry Seacombe, you know, the scene and stuff to come later. It's done with that winning, you know, almost like a naivety about him. You know, there's something that just makes it very forgivable about all these stuff we have coming up with him. You know, all the leering, lechery stuff coming up. He's completely forgiven for it because he's just such a warm, charismatic man. I think that's a big thing to take away from his character here. I think
he's got no hidden depths. What you see is what you get.
Yeah.
He does his emotions do turn on a dime, though, because he flies into a rage a couple of times, doesn't he? but no, generally speaking, he's just a very happy-go-lucky, avuncular chap that I'd quite like to be stuck on a cruise with Harry Seacombe. I think that would have been a very fine thing. Not playing this character, but Harry Seacombe in general.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I'd be right there.
So Dr. Burke, Tony can't get on the boat because he hasn't got a boarding pass or something. So he pretends to be a crew member loading luggage so he can get on.
Yeah.
And then we get our first glimpse of the ship's captain, the ever dependable Robert Morley. And I can always depend on him to annoy the hell out of me. And he bollocks Tony. I think that's the technical term. He bollocks Tony for wearing suede shoes and drops them in the water.
Yeah.
We've just missed somebody,
which I think will be interest to the goon fraternity. John Bluthal pops up as a taxi driver for Leslie Phillips in this opening.
He does. Blinking, yes. You miss him. Yes,
it really is. John Bluthal. Yeah. Yes. Looking very young, actually. He's there at the Southampton docks. I say Southampton docks. It was probably, you know, back of Pinewood somewhere.
Of course it is. And for reasons. Leslie Phillips, I'm going to just keep saying Leslie Phillips, I think, because it's simpler. Leslie Phillips, for reasons, gets knocked out temporarily, and by the time he comes to, it's dark, the ship has raised anchor, and the voyage has begun. So technically, he's a stowaway.
Uh-huh.
And then I think a very fine actor, one of my favourite films ever, is The Elephant Man.
Yes.
In which this actor plays a real shit, if you'll pardon the expression, Freddie Jones.
Freddie Jones. Yes.
Father of Toby.
Which I did not know until I did a bit of digging. Mm. And I can kind of see, you know, the comedy nuances, you know, being passed down. But I did not know that. And I was, you know, surprised to find that out. Yeah.
Toby Jones, who now is possibly, arguably, the one of the biggest television stars. I mean, he's a film star as well, but television stars in Britain, off the back of what's that, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office.
Yes, he's in very much in high demand at the minute. Yes.
And Freddie Jones has been in so many things over the years. He's no longer with us, is he?
No, he's not. But a very good turn, you know, very good turn indeed. Did some of the Hammer Horrors, I think, and was very good in those too. And Yeah, fine support here, you know, playing that kind of almost like a Windsor Davis kind of role, you know, it's all that kind of.
Yes, it would be that
kind of, you know, what's going on here kind of thing, you know, great stuff.
So what is he, master at arms? So he's basically in charge of ship discipline and...
That's right.
And he's got this kind of little sort of moustache that Hitler would
A little Hitler moustache, a little bit of a twitch in one eye, you know?
Yeah.
There's one bit later on when he's just barking orders at these two sailors, and you can't really figure out what he's saying. It's all that kind of stuff. It's very, very funny. I think it's great.
He pretty much twigs straight away.
Yes.
That Leslie Phillips is a stowaway, or
something's
might be a stowaway.
Awry. Yeah, something's awry, yeah.
Leslie Phillips gives Ophelia's cabin number as his. Mm-hmm. And when a little while later, Leslie Phillips opens the door to Freddie Jones, there's a, what is it, like a pink feather boa or something, or negligee, draped over his shoulders, and which makes, I'm just going to keep calling him Freddie Jones, makes Freddie Jones assume that he's a female impersonator.
Yes, this is an interesting scene because Leslie's character has to play up that he's a cross-dresser, you know, and this is 1970.
Yeah.
And it's you know, it's against that Leslie Phillips muscular kind of image, and he's there, you know, because he's not in drag. Don't forget, at this point, he's not in drag. That's to come, isn't it? But at this point, it's just insinuated, you know, to get out of this scrape, that he cross-dresses. So he does this really playful, just like touching up of Freddie Jones's outfit and this kind of stuff.
You're one of them.
Sometimes.
Oh. I was just asking, because, as a matter of fact, we often get the odd female impersonator aboard from time to time.
Must you go?
Just one more thing, sir.
For anyone.
On this ship, young ladies are not allowed in single gentlemen's cabins. Captain's orders. He doesn't care for premarital relations, as you might say, even if you do. Well, sir, I'll be popping along to the purser's cabin to do a spot of what you might call double-double checking. I shall see you later, sir. I have no doubt. I have no doubt either.
Now, Graham Stark, we see Graham Stark wearing in brown face.
Yes.
I must say. And the character is called Satterjee, I think.
Yep, yep.
And it makes Sellers, even Milligan's, portrayals of citizens of the Indian subcontinent seem understated by comparison.
Yeah.
You know, he's really playing it up.
And, he does stick out as a sore thumb here, I think. Yeah,
he really does.
Because
they have a because he's talking to lovely little, well, I say lovely, it's lovely because Harry's in it, but there's a scene with him and because he's a steward, an Indian steward, and he has a chat with Harry about, there's like a misunderstanding about Dunkirk, which involves the similarity between the sound of the two words bomb holes and bum holes. And we forgot to mention Basil Beecham is terminally seasick and he's confined to his cabin. We don't see him till a little bit later, but we have the first evening dinner. Mm-hmm. Harry Secombe Llewellyn arrives to dinner wearing like a dressing gown because for some reason he's chucked most of his clothes in the ocean, thinking the circular cabin window was a washing machine. Right?
I wish we'd seen that scene. I know it's a nice image without it, but I think Harry could have done math, you know, work miracles with that bit of. You know,
well, the thing is, right? Question, right? It's and I overthink these things. Two things. I don't think cabin windows open on cruise ships, for a start.
For that reason, yeah.
And secondly, he's only been on the boat a couple of hours. Why is he needing to wash his clothes? Anyway. Robert Morley is startled by his dressing gown and sends him off with a flea in his ear. And that's when Harry meets Dawn Daly.
Yes.
And you can tell she's put out that he has to sit with her because he's a common little fat man.
He is, yeah.
And but it's only when he mentions in passing, well, the first thing he says to her that he's a pools winner, and that's when her attitude towards him changes.
It does, yeah.
And we get that lovely shot, to end the scene of Harry Secombe ogling a pair of breasts.
As only Harry Secombe can.
Like, ooh. Did you see that food? You know, the 70s fancy food
some kind of trifle.
It's yeah, it's
icing on it. I don't know what it was.
You see photographs in like old magazines from the 70s of
exactly
of
like
desserts
that.
or yeah. whatever.
Yeah.
And they just seem they're like a colour that doesn't exist anymore, aren't they? So we see the next day Roddy, Graham Chapman, and the models having photographs taken around a drained pool.
Yes.
Leslie Phillips has had to sleep the night under the tarpaulin in a lifeboat.
Yeah.
And there's a there's a bit of unnecessary misunderstandings. Where Roddy, the photographer, thinks that Leslie Phillips is coming on to him. He's most upset when Leslie Phillips runs away.
And being chased by Freddie Jones.
Being chased by Freddie Jones.
I thought you were going to chase me.
I suddenly felt terribly tired.
Well, I'm very disappointed.
I'm terribly sorry, old chap. I just couldn't run another yard. Not one more yard.
I think Graham Chapman goes something like, him? Something like that. It's priceless. Yeah, that was very good. Very good.
Yeah. So Leslie Phillips ends up in Basil Beecham's cabin.
Oh, this is a good scene. This is a good scene where he basically, yeah, he pretends like the boat's rocking all over the place and he lists all the fried eggs and the bacon and all that kind of stuff. And I enjoy this. It's a good, it feels like a good little pantomime skit that they would have, you know, Leslie Phillips, and I'm talking about here, would have, you know, learned this kind of stuff and, you know, this kind of level of overacting, you know. I enjoyed this scene a lot. It's good fun. Well, especially when he's knocking the chandeliers. You know that bit?
Oh, yeah, but it's purely in the spirit of mischief, just to agonise Basil further, yeah. Yeah. but also he wants to be able to share the cabin so he's got somewhere to kip.
And nick his clothes, yeah.
And nick his clothes and eat his food.
Yes.
And I must say, Simon D, you know, he's in this film, but he's not in this film a lot, really, no. If you think about it. But he's not a bad actor. He comes across quite a credible actor.
No, he's fine. Yeah, he's very good. He's a good foil in many ways. When he's opposite Phillips, you know, it's very good.
I might as well take the opportunity now that we're talking about D.
Yes,
I just want to talk about him. But what do you know about him generally now in terms of just that he had a TV series and was
he was like a chat show host. I guess just before this, otherwise they wouldn't have, you know, given such high billing and made such a big deal out of it, I guess. But that's kind of all I know is that he slipped away and whenever Leslie Phillips kind of talked about it, he's always been like, oh, it's very sad what happened to Simon. And, you know, he's trying to do another comeback, whatever. And that's kind of like, that is literally all I know about him. I haven't spoke to my folks about him who were, you know, they would have been 14, 15 when this film came out. So they probably, you know of him. But I haven't asked them about him. So no, please educate me.
He became a Radio Caroline DJ. I think that's where his career began. Did a bit on the Home Service or the Light Program, and then he broke into TV by hosting Top of the Pops a couple of times and appeared regularly on Jukebox Jury.
Right.
And already at this point he was gaining a reputation for being difficult, just clashing with directors, with management, with crew. But then in 1967 the BBC. Commissioned D Time, which was like a chat show, and it you know, attracting audiences of 18 million or more, and it was just anybody who was everybody who was anybody appeared on D Time to promote whatever or just to talk about, you know, what was going on, and it was all the sort of hip and happening people of the moment. So Lulu, Marty Feldman, Petula Clark, of whom more later, John Lennon, Michael Caine, Jimi Hendrix. You know, Spike was on D Time, and then he just was throwing his weight around and attempting to dictate what guests he would have on the show, what hours he would work, what expenses he would claim, what advice he would accept. Okay, he was this is quite funny. In 1969, he was at the top of a blacklist drawn up by a society who were aiming to stamp out the use of the phrase, you know, on TV.
Wow.
Yeah, he was quite critical. I mean, this goes in the tick column, because he was quite vocally critical of Enoch Powell.
Yes.
He campaigned against nuclear testing, apparently. So, you know, in some ways he was on the right side. But
yeah.
But then he was lured away from BBC One to LWT.
Right.
And
that was the way at that point, wasn't it, really? There's a lot of that going on at that time.
Well, yeah, but they were kind of their programming, because they were launched in 68. Their programming was quite highfalutin, kind of arts and drama and ballet and opera and things like that. That you know, the audience at home didn't really want.
No.
So they were experimenting with changing programming and all sorts of things. So they lured Simon Dee from the BBC, and Dee tried to kind of get a counter offer. He went to Bill Cotton and said he'd been offered this job with LWT, and pretty much sort of said, you know, how much are you going to pay me to stay with the BBC? And Bill Cotton, who didn't really like him,
right,
basically suggested that he should have a pay cut instead of
right. Oh, wow, cost. Okay.
You know, if what you're saying to me is true, that you value the BBC, then yeah, you can stay here, but you'll have to take a 20% pay cut. And so Dee didn't like that, and he left and joined LWT. And there was clashes between him and David Frost, who was big within LWT.
Yeah.
And it started, I think, in January 1970, something like that. And 3 weeks after the release of Doctor in Trouble, the show was cancelled.
Oh,
And he was let go by LWT. Yeah. And he'd burned his bridges with the BBC, so there was no chance of going back there.
Yeah.
One of the shows that on the LWT series had George Lazenby, who was stoned, it would appear.
Yes.
And was going on about conspiracy theories about the death of Kennedy.
Oh, blimey.
And John and Yoko were on that show, and they were sort of encouraging George Lazenby in this sort of rambling.
Okay.
And then Simon Dee kind of thought that shadowy forces were after him, Simon Dee.
Right.
You know, so he was getting this kind of paranoia. And anyway, the point is he was from being a huge star, he was dropped by LWT, couldn't get a job anywhere else. So by the time this film comes out, he's pretty much, his career is on the skids.
Yeah.
6 months after the film came out, the Daily Mirror reported that he'd signed on. He'd had to queue up at the Fulham Labour Exchange to sign on, and he was interviewed by the Daily Mirror, and he said he'd been offered a job as a frozen food salesman, but he turned it down. Mm-hmm. He was offered a few, there was the odd sort of TV work that he was offered, but it was quite insulting, I suppose.
Below
him, yeah. And then he was up in front of a judge in 1971 for assaulting a bailiff who'd been attempting to make an inventory of his home. And he separated from his wife in 72. Good God, you know, just looking at this, he was put in jail for non-payment of speeding fines in 73, until his friends paid the debt and he was released. And this is the thing, right? In July 1974, he was in court for vandalising a toilet seat, right? Now,
you reach the bottom there, yes.
Now, on if you read Wikipedia, it says that the toilet seat, it was in some, I don't know, swanky emporium with kind of weird and wonderful things in it, including a toilet seat with the face of Petula Clark.
Oh, I wonder where you're going to bring that back.
Right. And he, now that's in Wikipedia, that's on Wikipedia. And right. But in actual fact, because, you know, I read a newspaper report from the time, it was actually Marilyn Monroe, Petula Clark. Now, I wish it had been Petula Clark, because that would be better. But he'd vandalized it with Marilyn Monroe on it because he said he found it disrespectful. And this may or may not, I'm not quite sure, have been the occasion when he'd faced the ultimate humiliation of being sent to prison by the part-time magistrate who happened to be his old nemesis, Bill Cotton.
Oh, goodness me, no, really?
Yeah. In 75, he trained to become a London bus driver, but he failed the test due to bad driving, as well as clashing with the union over not wanting to pay their fees. And
it's just a catalogue of
He was due in 1976 to start a new job on a local radio station in Reading, but walked out because he refused to interview Alvin Stardust, saying, "I don't even know the guy." And so on and so on and so on. And there was the odd sort of sporadic attempts at a comeback over the years, but it never happened. No. It never happened. And he just it's someone whose star shone very bright before burning out, as they say. So here you go. And a cautionary tale, I would say.
Sounds like he had quite an ego.
Oh, yes.
Which is weird, because you think that's the one thing you do not need to have as a chat show host. It's the one thing that would really put you off the job, really. You know, it's kind of the point, is it really? But, yeah.
So, back to the film. Apologies, listeners, if that was, you know, too much of a ramble about Simon Dee, but I thought it was interesting. Just as
I did not know 90% of that. So it's wow. When's Toby Jones going to do a biopic on him? You know,
that would make a great biopic.
It would, you know,
or
you
biopic.
Know. Yeah,
yeah. Now, so we've got Basil in bed, confined to bed because he's really seasick.
Yes,
even though it's like a milk pond in reality. And Leslie Phillips has been exaggerating. But then we get Robert Morley, the captain, goes to see Basil and just brusquely dismisses his protestations that he's
with a wet sponge.
Yeah. As soon as Basil gets out of bed and sees the sea is calm, he's better, isn't he?
Full recovery. Pretty much. Yeah.
I've got my notes here. Meanwhile, Harry Seacombe is on deck perving at birds.
Yeah, which I just want to bring this up again. Just the amount of nudity in this film. I'm trying to put it on a comparison with the Carry Ons at the time. And so Carry Ons came out, Up the Jungle came out early 1970, and it was followed by Carry On Loving, which would have come out late 1970. And, you know, they do have a bit of flashing going on here and there. But then I looked at this film and Leslie Phillips gets undressed about four different times.
Yeah, you see his bum.
And Angela Schuyler's flashing herself here and there. There's at least three separate photo shoots of the girls and the, you know, scantily clad girls. And then there's Harry Seacombe's topless scene.
Of course, gratuitous topless scene. we get a very brief moment with the great Fred Emney.
Yes. Well. Oh, brilliant, yes.
Who is he again? Is he the dad of... Is he the father of some girl that Harry tries to chat up?
I think. Yeah, there's. Yeah, it is at this point where Harry Seacombe's sunbathing, isn't he? going on, and this lass is talking about Marilyn Monroe again. She's stood above some kind of air vent, isn't she? And every now and then her dress billows.
That's right.
And and rather than her moving, she just keeps brushing it down, and it happens about three times.
Yeah.
Hello, darling. I've got the message. What's the next move?
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, come off it. You've been fancying me ever since breakfast. I saw that Tom Jones film, you know. The way you ate your grapefruit didn't leave much of the imagination.
This man annoying you, Melisse?
Just a minute. I saw her first. Besides, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You're old enough to be her father.
I am her father. Sex maniac.
Morning, Dad.
And Leslie Phillips confesses his situation to Basil back in the cabin.
Yes.
And this isn't Basil the character. This is now Simon Dee, I think, phones the bridge to grass him up.
Yeah, dobs him in.
that's when he gets called a bastard about a dozen times by Leslie Phillips, which I wasn't quite expecting.
No.
And he's just clad in his vest and pants, and he has to run out of the cabin. And, there's chases with Freddie Jones, and he falls down. What are those things called? The chute?
It's some kind thing. Of fog thing. I don't know. But, yes, he does fall down it. And I wrote down at this point in my notes, Benny Hill influence speeded up sequences. There's quite a few in this film. And of course, it was a trend at the time. But I think going back to the Simon Dia game, Benny Hill had just switched over onto LWT in 1969 as well. And then his, you know, from BBC, and then the shows he's now most remembered for, you know, his ITV days started then. So this was clearly started around that time as well. And yeah, there's some sequences which are speeded up for no reason at all. I'm going back to that first scene when Leslie Phillips arrives at 11 Clarence Crescent to go and see Simon D. You know, it's all speeded up. Even the music's speeded up. You're like, why?
Yeah.
It's not making it any funnier. Going on. But no, there's quite a few of these Freddie Jones chases Leslie Phillips around the quarterdeck, you know, going on, and it's all speeded up, and the xylophone music speeded up as well. And it just seems to have a very strong Benny Hill influence of this film, yeah.
Yeah, do you remember that compilation? There was a feature film which was basically a compilation of Benny Hill television sketches.
Yes, the very best of Benny Hill, yes. Right. 1974, yeah.
Now, do you remember there's a sketch in there where he's a television personality. He's driving a sports car, and he's got a dolly bird next to him, and he's a chat show host, and he's interviewing...
Yeah.
There's a vicar with his flies open, I think, at one point.
Yeah, he's trying to move the flower vase, yeah, to mask the camera shot, yeah.
Is it called Tommy Tup?
Tommy Tea Time or something, yes. It's like Simon D show.
Yeah, that's who he was. That was a parody of Simon D.
Wow.
Yeah. Bring it back full circle.
Yeah.
My next guest has come from the West End of London. He is one of London's biggest West End stars. I know you're going to make him very welcome. Here he is, Rodney Fairchild. Absolutely splendid of you to come along and be my guest on this show. I really am absolutely thrilled that you have been able to find time to come along. You have a reputation of being quite a hellraiser. Do you feel this reputation is justified in any way? That you have? This, you know, of being a hellraiser. Do you feel in any way justified at all? This reputation that you have?
No.
Well, there you are. Bless my soul. It's just sort of newspaper publicity. They put labels on people, don't they? They sort of, you know, they'll put labels on. But I suppose they put a label on you, sort of more. You know, sort of like publicity. Would you say it was publicity? I suppose it's publicity, is it? Is it publicity?
Well, yes.
Honestly, yes, I'm quite surprised about that. Does it worry you on this reputation, wrong and false that may be? Or does it worry you at all, the reputation that you've got? I mean, does it worry you in any way at all?
No.
Well, there you are. Honestly, I could go on talking with you all night.
And the marvellous Irene Handel makes her entrance.
Yes, a late appearance I've noted down here. I thought she was in this film, you know, all the way through, so to speak, once they got on boat. But no, it's quite a late appearance here. Yeah, I mean, I could have Irene Handel, you know, handle the whole film.
All right.
But, you know, well, I could, you know, I could watch her in anything, and she always plays these supporting roles, doesn't she? And I just wish there'd been some films where she actually did take the main role and been given that. Maybe she didn't want it. I don't know. Maybe she was just very happily, you know, supporting role and, you know, coming on,
yeah,
doing her turn and getting the money with her dog and then walking off, you know.
Yeah.
but you know, she's on fine form here, and they were good at this, the Doctor films, I think, you know, all of them. They had a very good core of, you know, your Leslie Phillips's or your Dirk Bogarde's and your Kenneth Moore's and your, you know, James Robinson Justice and Joan Sims as well. She's in a lot of them. But they always found room for really impressive guest stars.
Yes.
Arthur Haynes in the previous one, Fenella Fielding's in the previous one as well. Dennis Price pops up in one of them. You know, just really good character actors. And here we have, like it or not, Robert Morley.
Yeah.
But Irene Handel is here. And, you know, If someone came into this chat and said Aaron Handel steals the film, you know, I'd be like, do you know what? You're probably quite right, to be honest.
Yes, indeed. She refers to, I think she's angling. She wants to marry her daughter Dawn off.
Yes,
and I think she's got notions that she'd like to marry her off to the captain, to Robert Morley.
Yes. That's her A game, isn't it? That's the top prize. Yeah.
Because he's a highly eligible bachelor.
Yes.
And then we've got luncheon is served and Harry arrives in full evening wear and everyone stares at him, including Robert Morley, of course. And he disdainfully informs Llewellyn that they only wear black tie at dinner.
Yes.
And we get a lovely raspberry from Harry as he
storms
out.
Yes, I noted that down. Yes, it's marvellous, isn't it?
And Leslie Phillips crawls out of whatever it was that he fell down, totally blackened.
Yes.
And he has to explain. He goes to Ophelia's cabin and explains the situation to her. And at one point he says he really digs her.
Yes.
Yeah, which just doesn't sound right coming out of Leslie Phillips.
No, it just doesn't, doesn't it? No, it really doesn't. No.
And we have all the events leading up to Freddie Jones arriving at the cabin and Leslie Phillips in drag, trying to obviously escape.
Yeah.
Looking like Roy Barraclough doing an impression of Penelope Keith.
I'd watch it. I'd pay to watch that.
Yeah. A character called Lavinia.
Lavinia Paxenbury. Yeah. Mm. Lav for short. Yeah, this is a good old trope, isn't it? And it was a matter of time until there'd be some drag in it somewhere. And great fun. And of course he loses the mustache here, doesn't he? And he doesn't fit for the rest of the film. It's not many films I think where Les Phillips is, you know, without his trademark mustache really.
Do you know, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, now you mentioned it. Yeah.
I kind of thought it was that kind of a film, that kind of a period of time where they might have tried to have kept it, and so the Freddie Jones would have fallen for her, you know. She's very hairy upper lip, that's all, you know. And there's like that great shot of Freddie Jones when he does literally tumble, who Lavinia is, where I think they're doing a bit of, you know, a bit of patter cake amongst them, and then he hits her too hard, Phillips too hard, and Phillips falls backwards, and then he catches Lavinia. he's basically got his legs splayed around Freddie Jones' crotch on show, and Freddie Jones' face is just so good. It's so perfectly over the top. It's wonderful. And Leslie Phillips crawling back up, you know, and his wig's off and all sorts of things. Brilliant stuff. Yeah, I'm all that kind of comedy, good broad stuff, yeah.
So he's rumbled, and so he's taken to see the captain. And because Robert Morley's brother, Lancelot Spratt.
Remember him, folks?
knows Dr. Tony Burke, the captain's inclined to be lenient, and appoints him as his personal steward, which basically means being a skivvy.
Yeah.
On the ship.
Yeah.
And he has to share a cabin with Graham Stark, who is naturally learning English very badly and standing on his head when doing yoga.
Yes, that's all.
And then we got dinner and Harry arrives, shot tastefully from sort of nipples up, I think, more or less, wearing just a black tie.
Yeah.
Oh, the humanity.
I remember the first time I watched this film, in my early teens, and I thought that was the best joke in the whole film. You know, I told you to wear, you know, bow tie, nothing else, you know, black bow tie, nothing else. And I thought that joke was brilliant. And the way it just kind of laboriously just unravels with the whole room just by table falling silent. And Harry Secombe just descending those little set of stairs and just walking around the tables, and he gets the high-ranking table and they're all just aghast. And it's very, very well played, I think. Ralph Thomas, who directs it, you know, that's a very good, you know, top draw scene, I think.
No, I'm not saying that Harry Secombe was kind of like, you know, the Daniel Day-Lewis of his day, but if he had been method,
oh yes,
I'd like to think he would have gone with it and
absolutely
had his lad out on show. Not for us, but for the, you know, the rest of the cast and crew.
Yeah, it's funny that around this same time of the film, which I guess is over 2/3 of the film, you know, that kind of running gag is now milked for its worth. You know, that's kind of put to bed. That's likewise, it. The Freddie Jones chasing Leslie Phillips, I'm not going to say subplot, but, you know, trait is put to bed. And from here onwards, it's I don't know, because those two elements have kind of gone a bit, it does feel a bit like treading water until we get to the actual carnival scene. But that's just my own opinion, I think.
Or falling into water, because Ophelia falls overboard and Leslie Phillips...
Yes, gets knocked in.
Gets knocked in, but he can't swim and she saves him and blah, blah, blah. And the ludicrous bit when they're back on board and Leslie Phillips is being examined by the ship's doctor, and then Tony, quick as a flash, tells him that he's got hepatitis africonia.
Yes.
Which the symptoms are these really unnatural looking red spots the size of a 10p piece.
It's a wonderful actor called Jimmy Thompson, who worked a lot for Betty Box and Peter Rogers in the 60s. And yeah, he's here as the actual ship's doctor, isn't he? And the way they do about it is they've literally just, you know, screenshot his face. And then they've just added two more spots, taken a photograph, added two more spots, taken a photograph. You know, they do that about 5 times. And that's because that's what happened, folks. That's how it works.
And of course, it puts the ship's doctor out of commission, which gives a great opportunity for Leslie Phillips to be promoted to ship's doctor. Yeah. And I could have done without the scene where Robert Maul is talking about his constipation, to be honest.
Oh, yes. That's just to set up the final bit, isn't it? Yes.
I wrote down here, and this is probably an old joke, but I wrote down verbatim what was said in this scene, and I just wrote, wow, because I'd not heard this joke before. And it's Irene Handel visits Leslie Phillips, the doctor, and tells him that she wants the pill for Dawn.
Yes.
I don't know why she's gone, because Dawn's a grown adult, but anyway. And then there's this dialogue between Irene Handel and Leslie Phillips.
Has she had them before?
Yes, but they keep falling out.
I think it'd be a good idea, Mrs. Daly, for you to ask your daughter to come along and have a little chat with me.
Right? Point taken, will do. And I'm inertly grateful to you, Doctor. I mean, we are a bit too top draw to want to join the Puddin' Club, aren't we?
And we get the climax. Is it the climax of the film almost? It's the fancy dress cocktail party.
Yes.
And Harry Secombe's cheesed off because he's not been invited. But then he somehow manages to get inveigle himself. And Basil turns up dressed as his Dr. Dare character, and then but he's annoyed that half of the other male passengers seem to have done the same. Irene Handel's kind of in this Marie Antoinette outfit.
Yeah, yes.
Leslie Phillips has done up as Julius Caesar.
Yeah, Nero he reminds me of Nauseous from Pompeii. It's that kind of outfit.
Yeah. And then Harry arrives dressed as Robert Morley.
Yes.
Well, the captain, I should say. With and Morley's been sipping orange juice laced with castor oil. For his constipation. So he gives Harry the drink. Which obviously means that Harry starts, you know, having problems. Has to nip off to the bog on a regular basis. There's the dance, Harry bumps into someone dressed up as Cleopatra, and we get the obligatory asp gag.
Yeah, always welcome.
Yep. At one point Irene Handel's wig gets caught in his zip.
It flies.
Yeah.
This is it. It's a lot more bawdier. It's a it lot is. More laboratorial humour than the, you know, the days of Kay Kendall and you know, Dirk Bogarde romancing, you know, in the 1950s. You know, it has moved on so much, this series, by this point, yeah.
And there's the striptease, as we mentioned.
Yes.
And it's curtailed. I think Robert Morley asks for there to be an alarm set off to try and bring an end to it all. And it panics the passengers. And we get Graham Stark falling into the pool. And but remarkably, his makeup doesn't wash off.
Yes.
And Basil, or should I say Simon D,
proves
that he's like, you know, he's a shit on the scale of that. What's that guy from the Titanic? Bruce Ismay, was that his name?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he pinches Leslie Phillips's life vest.
That's right. Yeah.
And be first on the lifeboats, and then it turns out, obviously, it's a false alarm.
That's right.
And then we have this kind of weird ending, really, where there's an SOS.
You kind of feel the film sorted itself out, but no, there's this extra. Epilogue, it feels like, really. Extra.
And I'd forgotten, there's two people in this film that I'd forgotten about. I'd seen their names in the opening credits. And it's not till, the last 10 minutes of the film, Leslie Phillips has to be winched across water to a Russian frigate.
Yeah.
Because he needs to perform an emergency appendectomy.
That's right.
And the captain, the Russian captain, is Joni Sims.
There we go. Joan's been in a few of these films. She's in the first one, 1954, and it was her cameo in that which brought her to the attention of Peter Rogers. So that's kind of how she loosely became involved with the Carry On series. And she's certainly in Doctor in Love. She's in Doctor in Clover, and her roles got bigger with the films. So I think in Doctor in Clover, she actually plays the matron. Which incidentally was how it came about that she was offered matron in Carry On Doctor, because Hattie Jakes had not made a Carry On for about 3 years by that point.
Yeah.
So she kind of faded from the series. And Joan Sims, God bless her, when she read the Carry On Doctor script, I was like, thanks for offering me the matron, but you know, this is clearly a role written for my friend Hattie Jakes. And Peter Rogers gave it to Hattie Jakes, and she was, you know, back in the series. And Joan Sims, excellent in the one of what she played. She played Frankie Howard's very doting, I guess, secretary kind of role. And so she's back here. Yeah, very small role. And you're right at the end of the film, kind of forgotten where she's going to be in the film. And she crops up, yes. And she applies a numbing agent, doesn't she, to the patient, so to speak, by just walloping him in the face.
Yeah.
I make him sleep. Bang. He sleep.
Joan Sims, she could play simpering. She could play dowdy. She could play hard-faced. She could play glamorous.
Yeah.
You know?
All in the same film sometimes.
Yeah.
And they were very good friends, Leslie Phillips and Joan Sims. They loved working together. They had the same kind of work ethics and that kind of stuff. So I know they always enjoyed it. In fact, Leslie Phillips has gone down on record as saying how much of a friend Harry Secombe became, you know, from working on this film. And
He loved
meeting up with his family and that. And he said, I've got it down here from his autobiography, one of the nicest people I ever met. There we go. Leslie Phillips and Harry Secombe. Very jolly, very... Yeah.
And Harry's gone on record and said that, yes, he was making films around this period, quite a few, but he was always kept down to earth by Myra, his wife.
When I come back from golf, it's Arnold Palmer's old men. When I get home from the film studio, it's, come on, Gregory Peck, get some coal to the fire. When she came home from the nursing home with my fourth child, I won't tell you what she said. Anyway, just starting with a kiss of life. Anyway, but really, you know.
Yeah, and the thing is, right, he does this appendectomy. Successfully, and everyone applauds because they're all watching, all the Russian sailors. Okay, so he's kind of getting, in a way, Dr. Tony Burke is getting the sort of audience that Dr. Dare.
Yes, I suppose. Yes.
But yeah, once he's finished, he's dismayed to find that the Golden Horn has sailed off without him, which I think is a bit on the nose, isn't it, really?
It is a bit, rather.
And he has to stay on the ship, and they're off to Grimsby.
They're off to my hometown of Grimsby, yes.
Ah, okay.
So yeah, I love that widget because I thought, you know, where are we docking? Our first port, Grimsby. Always gets a little cheer in the John Hughes household, yeah.
Cut to, like, I guess a week or two passes, and Tony pulls up again in a taxi, not driven by John Bluthal this time.
No.
The Golden Horn's just docked, and the passengers are disembarking, and he rushes up to Ophelia to finally propose to her, and then she tells him that she's married the ship's doctor because she'd always wanted to marry a doctor.
Yeah.
And Leslie Phillips says, well, what about me? And she said, well, you never asked me. Which is true.
Well, yeah.
Harry Secombe has also got married. He got married to Dawn.
Yes.
But it's only as they're getting off the ship that he reveals to them, her and her mother, that he's not actually all that rich. He's got a motorcycle and a sidecar and a nice one-room flat at 30 bob a week.
Yeah, she's like, Irene Handel says something like, you know, how are you going to keep my daughter happy? And he just lists off this thing like, oh, there's a white fridge, there's an ironing board, there's all these mod cons in the kitchen. Goodness me.
Irene Handel's face is black as thunder.
Yeah.
And then... again, a name that I saw in the opening credits and I'd forgotten. Yeah. Jackie Piper turns up because we've got Tony, Dr. Burke, crestfallen. He's about to get back in his taxi. And then Jackie Piper, she sort of tries to come on to Tony.
Yes.
And ask if she can share his taxi. But then it's just so that she can call over her large family who all cram into the taxi.
Yeah, it's another one of those endings where you think you know what's coming and then no, it's pulled away again. And nice, nice little tag, nice little button on the whole film.
Yeah. So we've whipped through that, but I mean, are there favourite bits that I forgot to mention that you want to talk about?
I think it's just, you know, like all these films, you know, it's a film of its time. And I think it was very brave in many ways when you watch it in the context in which it was made. You know, they were trying to sort of, you know, make it connect with the ITV series, the other T series, which is clearly, you know, going from strength to strength. And there had been a 4-year gap from the previous film. And, you know, we're used to 4-year gaps, 5-year, 10-year gaps in between film franchises, you know, these days. But back then, you know, that was probably quite a hefty gap. You know, the Bonds would turn them out every 2 years, you know, carry on every 2 months.
you know,
but for a 4-year gap probably did say, you know, the writing on the wall, and you know, the gig was up, really. I was just amazed when I rewatched it, just how much it is more akin to the 70s Carry On films, more than obviously the 50s Doctor films or even the 60s Doctor films, you know, which should keep up with the times. One thing else I read was this is one of the very few films Leslie Phillips owns a percentage of. Betty Box was struggling to raise the money for this one, and so they offered him a cut of the percentages, which he took. So he's gone down his record as saying it's his favourite film. It'll be shown more so that he'll get some residual fee from it.
Well, it's hardly Alec Guinness in Star Wars, though, is it? Let's face it. Very good, very good. So before we wrap up, if you don't mind, John, I just want to mention sort of podcast news here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what I hope to introduce on GoonPod as additional content, bonus content, will be a monthly bonus episode in which myself and guests look at favourite British comedy films in general.
Great.
And these can be any, well, classic or not so classic films, as long as they're British comedy films.
Yeah,
and they can be from the, you know, 30s up to present day, really, or earlier. But the one stipulation is that they must not contain a single goon. So no Sellers, no Milligan, Secombe or Bentine.
Okay.
But there'll be chats in the usual GoonPod house style, all over the shop and rambling and wittering on and all that sort of thing, but hopefully entertaining to listeners. And I've got a number of guests scheduled to record later this year. And I'll share a handful of the films that we hope to cover. Uh-huh. Maybe not all this year, but certainly some of these will be. Billy Liar, Kind Hearts and Coronets.
Yeah.
Stepped on Sunride Again.
Ooh, You Are Awful.
Yeah. Ooh, You Are Awful. Shaun of the Dead, even, which is quite modern for this podcast.
It is, yeah.
And I've got guests that have agreed to guest, the likes of, they've all been on the show before, these people: Chris Diamond, Jeremy Lin, Paul Litchfield, David Quantock, Tim Worthington, even, whisper it, David Renwick.
Superb. Yeah.
Who I'm hoping, he said he's up for it, will want to come on and talk about the film version of Whoops Apocalypse.
So, I love that film.
I haven't seen it for years, so I'll have to reacquaint myself with that. Now, this monthly bonus episode will probably be kicking in around sort of July, June, July, something like that. And it will be on Patreon. So it'll be around, if people want to listen to it, it'll be around £3 a month.
Okay? Right.
But you know, when did you last spend £3 on such a bargain?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in the future, I intend to offer other bonus content, whatever that may be, but I'll be guided by you lot on what they could be. And I know some people may grumble that I'm monetizing the podcast, but it's you know, the regular podcast, the weekly podcast, will be totally free as the air that you breathe, you know, no change. And it just, it will help keep it running, keep it growing, and also help cover costs and things like that.
I'm all for it. I think it's great. Well supported as well.
So whenever that starts, there is a Patreon GoonPod page. It's patreon.com/GoonPod.
Yeah.
And I'll be posting more and more stuff there as it grows. And you can join for free, you know. And then if you want to get the bonus episode or episodes, you can then change to the paid tier. I think that's how it works.
So that
will be happening. As I say, you know, apologies for going off on one about that, but I just wanted to I'm just starting to promote that now, so
that's great.
So John, what about you? What have you got in terms of your professional career? What have you got coming up, or what are you working on at the moment?
I am touring a self-penned theatre show called Maybe Dick.
Oh, yes, I saw that. I was reading about that, yes. So that's great.
Yeah, it's very much a... I'm very grateful that I've had some really nice reviewers come along, and they've said, you know, if you want to see Carry On Moby Dick, this is the show for you. And, you know, little old me, I would love to go and see Carry On Moby Dick. So I'm very, very proud. Very proud that people...
Well, Kenneth Williams was in Moby Dick.
He was. Yes, he was.
Yeah.
With Orson Welles behind him.
Orson Welles, yeah.
So I'm touring that at the minute, and I'm really enjoying that. And it's just a really good night out, and it's just all this kind of comedy, and it's nice to know there's still an audience for it, if I'm honest. And then later on this year, we are staging a revival of the lost TV episodes of Hancock's Half Hour. So that's
cool.
Yeah, right. So it's 100 years of Hancock this year, 70 years of radio.
And
the BBC have done a great job in re-recording the lost radio episodes with Kevin McNally. And but there's still 2022 lost TV episodes, you know, recorded, transmitted, missing, presumed, wiped. Scripts still survive, and they're very, very funny. They're very, very good. And with a little bit of adaptation, you know, they suit the stage world very, very well. So we're doing 3 episodes of that September to November. And I'm just currently in the pre-production stages for that. And again, going across the UK with it. And I'm so excited and you know, very, very lucky to be entrusted with that, you know, because...
Yeah.
It's such a, you know, it is comedy royalty, you know, this kind of stuff, isn't it? So to be entrusted with it and to be doing it at all feels very, very, I feel very privileged indeed to be entrusted with that. And it's, again, nice to know there's an audience for it. You know, it'll be very well supported, I'm sure.
Oh, Hancock's still very, very popular, as are the Goons.
Yeah.
And of course, there was a lost episode of the radio show turned up recently, waiting to hear it, with Harry Secombe.
Yes, yes, it did, didn't it? Yeah. Is there any plans for that to be?
There is. I think it's being, I presume it's being cleaned up or whatever.
Probably held back for Christmas or something like that.
Maybe, yeah, because there was the Peter Sellers episode of Hancock's Half Hour that was filmed a year or so ago. So
that was series two, early episode series two, wasn't it? The radio series when Hancock went April, pretty much.
Oh, the Harry Secombe one, yeah. I think so. Harry was in three episodes.
Yes,
but the third episode, which I think this one is, he's only in it briefly. I think Hancock's back by then, and he thanks Harry for looking after the shop or whatever.
That was strange.
Away, yeah. So keep your eyes on social media and whatnot for news of that.
Yeah,
folks, and John, you know, please do come back sometime. And if you want to talk about something else, you know.
Oh, I'd love to talk about some of the other films. Yeah, I'd love to. So yeah, no problem at all. I'd love to. It's exactly my realm. when everyone else was you know, either watching, you know, football or the films of the Lord of the Rings trilogy or whatever else was going on at school or that, I was just completely enraptured by this kind of comedy. And yeah, long may it continue. And the work you do, and you know, into you know, just extend these legacies. It's fantastic and should be applauded, I think, all the time, yeah.
Thank you very much. Can I have that in money, please?
You can.
John, thanks a lot, mate. We'll talk again soon.
Cheers, Tyler.